along the course of this study, I thought we would never finish. This is a long book. This is our third year that we have been attempting on Sunday nights to work our way through the book of Genesis. And we have arrived at basically the last section here that's going to run all the way through to the end of Genesis. And I call it the story of Joseph, but in fact that is a bit of a misnomer because there's a lot more going on than just the personal biography of Joseph. You'll remember the way in which we're trying to approach this book. First of all, trying to study it as literature and recognize that often these stories work in ways that are different from other parts of the Bible. And trying to see a lot of these connections between stories and these ways in which the author sometimes subtly gets across his point. And then also trying to keep in mind that every story in one way or another is contributing to the grand story of God's redemption. This is the first book of the Bible, the first chapter of redemptive history. And it really does set the stage for the story of the abounding grace of God over the sin of man and setting up for the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. So we're trying to keep everything in perspective that way. And that may be a little bit of an unusual thing to do when you come to the story of Joseph, because perhaps in the past, as you have thought about Joseph, what stands out are truths about his own personal character and his own godliness and how his life is an example. And all of that is true. In fact, the New Testament itself picks up on Joseph as an example for the believer. But that's only a part of the story, and that's really not the main part either. We wouldn't be asking, how does this story contribute to this plan of God's redemption and the promises that he has made about salvation? What I would like to do in getting into this chapter is, first of all, just to read through it. And as we try to do sometimes, read through it and point out the main sections or breaks in the story. And then come back and try to choose out some of the most important information that will help us understand the point, the theme. So I'm going to give you here a basic outline. It's very simple for the story of chapter 37. And starting off, remember it starts off in verse 2. Last time we pointed out that chapter 37, verse 1 was wrapping up the line of Esau, and that it was presenting for us a contrast between the nature of Esau's life and what we can expect regarding Jacob and his people. But actually, the story now begins in verse 2 with that very well-known phrase, "These are the generations." We get into that concept of a new line of people, what's going to come of their line. And even though it says, "These are the generations of Jacob," that is a way of actually introducing stories about the children, the sons of Jacob, the outcome of these descendants of his. And you see there the basic divisions. We'll read this section by section, beginning of verse 2, where you have the basic setting of the story, and Joseph, as the main character in the story, is introduced. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, probably meaning that he worked alongside of them. Bilhah and Zilpah were his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. That statement really gets the story going. There's a conflict that's introduced. It's what we might call the inciting moment. It's what gets the tension of the story rolling. What's going to happen? How is this conflict going to unfold? And it actually gets worse as far as Joseph is concerned. Reading on from verse 5 to verse 8, we have the record of the dreams of Joseph. He's, I would imagine, unintentionally going to add fuel to the fire of his brother's hostility. Verse 5, now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. Behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. Behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. There in verse 8, we finish out the record of the first dream, but that section actually goes on for a bit more with a second dream that he has, very similar to it, but actually more involved. Verse 9, then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. At this point, the heat really ramps up because the brothers are going to have an unexpected opportunity to take out their hostility on their brother. They are able to come up with this plan to sell him off, beginning in verse 12. We'll read starting there. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. I'll just stop there. It's kind of an ironic twist that those words actually reflect his spirit and this whole relationship. He was physically looking for them and just on an errand for his father, but on a deeper level, he was seeking his brothers. Well, he's going to find them, but they're not going to really be acting like brothers. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They've gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. We are in verse 18 and reading now the actual plot that they come up with. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." And when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, a robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. They sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him up out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. And now the brothers are going to deceive their father about what has taken place. Reuben has to find out first. Verse 29, when Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" And they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son, mourning." Thus his father wept for him. The last verse takes you back to Joseph as to what happened with him. He's actually sold again in verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him to Egypt. I sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. What do you make of those events, and what in the world do they have to do with this story of God's redemption? It sounds kind of like God's redemption is falling apart in the chosen line, and they are killing each other off, or wanting to, but deciding that they're actually going to make money off of each other and selling this brother off into slavery, and then on top of that, deceiving their father about what had taken place. It's a little hard to know what to make of it, especially when you consider a simple fact. Did you find the word God in that whole chapter? You did not read the word God, Jehovah, anything like that. There is no direct reference to the Lord. And as you read it, you really get the impression, looking at it from a human standpoint, God must be taking a break. Maybe God is worn out from everything else he's been doing in this book, and he just backed off a bit and was allowing something to happen here, a mess that he's going to have to clean up later. What are we going to do now with this family torn apart? The Lord is silent throughout these events. And in fact, he's going to be silent some more, because you read verse 36, you're wondering what's going to happen to Joseph in Egypt, but then you've got this, what seems to be long interruption, the story of Judah and Tamar, which in addition to being very troubling on a moral level, is also very distracting, because you're wanting to know what happened to Joseph. And it's going to be a while before you find out. And actually for him, it's going to be a good while longer before things really begin to get any better for him. The Lord is silent. And that kind of silence represents a shift that has been gradually going on throughout this book. Now, as Bible-believing people, we understand the sovereignty of God. We believe that God has a plan, that God is causing all things to work together to accomplish his plan, and particularly when it has to do with this chosen line. But throughout the book, God's involvement has been getting less and less direct. And it seems to be that events are taking their quote-unquote normal course, and you find less and less of God actually speaking to people, of God intervening and performing great miracles like he did back there with Abraham and Sarah and so forth. And that is the sense overall throughout a lot of this last section of Genesis, that God, as it were, is on a break, leaving these men to do whatever they feel like doing. This situation is just totally out of control. Do you ever feel like that? I wonder, in your life, because I know I could say this in my life, probably within the last week, I have felt like that. Where in the world is God? I mean, I know what the Bible says, but as I look at the circumstances, they don't match up very well. Is my life just kind of on hold here? Is he paying any attention? Is he going to follow through with what he has promised? How does this event or that event relate to his program of redemption? What in the world is going on? Is God silent? Well, it seems to me that throughout this section of Genesis, and particularly here at the very beginning, that is the kind of struggle that the reader is supposed to feel. Because that's precisely what Joseph was feeling as these events are getting off the ground. And yet, as you look at it, you also have all of this woven together in such a way that it's very clear things are not always as they seem. And there's always more going on than you realize. We're going to start with the negative part, and we are going to consider the various ways in which it appears to be that God is silent. His name does not occur, and there are many events here that seem so out of keeping with his character that you really begin to wonder. What do you think as you look back at that story? What are some of the factors that demonstrate, humanly speaking, what we would conclude is a silent God? Well, it's all in the personal and family relationships and how people are treating each other and the outcome of their treatment of each other. Starting with the comments that are made at the beginning in that section about the setting regarding the father figure here. And there is a negative picture painted regarding the human authority and his great lack of wisdom in how he was handling his family. An unwise father. That is a part of the problem that causes people to wonder, where is God? People in leadership over your life that seem to be making foolish choices. What is a choice? Specifically here, what it says in verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age. If there was anybody in the world who should not have made this mistake, it should have been Jacob. I mean, this whole long story we've been reading about his life was all about this tangle between him and his brother, and it was all about split affections within the family, and the mother is over here on this side, the father's over here on this side, and all of the heartache and all of the disaster that came out of that, and now he does the very same thing. It's kind of hard to, you know, give a ranking of sinners in Genesis. I suppose that Adam would have to be the worst, but as I have read through this book, it doesn't get any lower than Jacob in many respects. The foolishness of his choices, the selfishness of his choices, and even though we have seen the Lord gradually growing him, here he is in his old age, having been through all that, and he's doing the same dumb things. And people who are in his family under him, that's what they're feeling. And it's as though nothing's ever going to change, and this is never going to be solved, and his family's always going to be dysfunctional. And where's God? Well, Joseph gets even more attention from his father as you read on. Of course, we read there in verse 3 about this robe of many colors that he is given. And that's probably something that you have wondered about in the past. Your Bible may have a note explaining that translation, many colors, is based on the Greek version of the Old Testament. But more than likely, it's not talking about the colorfulness of the robe, but it's talking about the style of it. Perhaps a very long flowing robe, or perhaps a robe with long and puffy sleeves. We're not totally sure. The only other place that this occurs is in 2 Samuel 13, verses 18 and 19, where it describes the dress of a princess. And oddly enough, her name was Tamar. That's over in the story about David. But this describes the clothing of a princess. And that's significant, because what's happening here is that symbolically, Jacob is going to communicate, this is not just my favorite son, I'm actually viewing him as the primary heir. I'm putting him in a position of authority. Even though he is younger, I'm putting him in a position of authority over his brothers. And you would have thought, again, that he would realize the impact that was going to have on his family. And nevertheless, when it comes to verse 12, he's sending Joseph on this errand as a kind of a policeman or informant. And he's sending him down there far away to, or up there far away to Shechem to get information about how things are going with the brothers and the sheep and so forth. Does not appear to be a wise move from a parenting standpoint when you know there's all this tension to just keep shoving your favorite son forward and putting him in this awkward position. And God's letting all that happen. God is letting all that happen. Now, what about Joseph? This is the one I've struggled with probably the most here because Joseph, for the most part, is presented so positively in this book that I hate to say anything negative about him. I have been surprised that so many commentators really do go after him. And I think that maybe the most gracious thing we can say is that at this point, 17 years old, he does reflect a bit of immaturity in the way that he responds to the privilege that his father gives him. And what is he doing in those verses? Well, in chapter 37, verse 2, it says he brought a bad report of them to their father. That term, bad report, usually in the Old Testament, particularly just as an example, Proverbs 10:18 is referring to something that is overly negative, even can be translated as slander in some cases, perhaps indicating that he was exaggerating the report and getting out of hand a bit in describing whatever these men were doing. And then, of course, you question his wisdom, again, knowing that there were these tensions of blurting out about the dreams, and perhaps there would have been a more discreet way of approaching that. Perhaps that should have been shared only with the father. A little hard again to know what to make of all that, but at the very least, it seems that he should have known this was going to cause some difficulty and maybe there was some other way to handle it. But of course, the big problem you see is that the brothers are so antagonistic to him. And we have read the story, and you may have picked up the several times that makes a comment about their strong negative feelings. And I'm just going to list them here without spending too much time, but it mentions hatred in three verses. It mentions jealousy in verse 11. Of course, you have the cruelty that comes up beginning of verse 12 of how they want to kill him and do away with him and so forth. And of course, Reuben being the firstborn and probably feeling like he needs to justify himself a little bit, given some of the other events in the book and be more on his father's side, sticks up for Joseph and is looking for a way to free him and says, put him in this pit, and thinking that he would get around to freeing him eventually. And then as you read on, the worst comes from Judah with his total betrayal. Sometimes you read what people say and you really struggle with the logic of how does that follow. When he says to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? So his concern is for profit. In other words, he not only wants to get him out of the way, which is bad enough, he wants to get something for himself, make a profit off of the deal. And so he said, let's sell him and let not our hand be upon him. So there is a bit of guilt there, not love, but guilt. For after all, he is our brother, our own flesh. Well, good night. If you really cared about him being your brother, your own flesh, why would you do this as opposed to the other? And yet, that is what is characterizing his family. Now, I'm sure we have folks here from all kinds of dysfunctional family backgrounds. And perhaps as you think about these events, you are thinking of parallel circumstances in your life growing up or in the life of your parents. And you know something of the level of tension here. God has spared some of us from that kind of experience in our early years. And yet, this is real life. This is how it is in so many families. Maybe not these exact details, but this kind of antagonism, and particularly for those kind of people, it is really a struggle. Where was God when all of this took place. How could he have let this happen? Was he just ignoring me? Did I not count? Did I not matter? And there goes Joseph, betrayed by the hand of his brothers. You have a few others that are mentioned toward the end of the chapter. Don't get confused there with this connection between the Ishmaelites and the Midianites. That may have raised a question for you. We're not going to have time to trace all that out, but there seems to have been a history of intermarriage between these peoples to the point where their names could be swapped back and forth. They were kind of all melded together. And yet, for our purposes, what we're concerned about is these actually were related to him as well. They were more distant relatives beyond the brothers here, but they were related nonetheless. And yet, they seem to have no trouble putting down money for him, and they put down 20 shekels of silver, which at that time was kind of a standard going rate for the slave trade. What in the world is happening here when everybody that you would expect to have been on his side, whether his distant relatives or his brothers, would have somebody really work hard, even Reuben? Why did he not take an immediate stand and have exerted more force and have delayed knowing the spirit of these brothers for him? It just seems like the whole world is against him, and even what his loving father does is just making life more and more complicated for him. And this is where we leave Joseph. He has traveled a great way away from his father. When it speaks there of his trip from Hebron to Shechem, that was a 50-mile trek. Then he finds out that actually they are 13 miles further to the northwest in Dothan, and he's out there isolated, far away from his father, nobody at all to protect him. And it's just a very sad picture as you read along here. A lot of little touches here. I'm not wanting to get too bogged down this evening, but even the comments that are made about the fierce animals, to pick up on that, where they're saying, let's pretend as though a fierce animal has killed him. That is what eventually they told the father. But then right after, in verse 25, then they sat down to eat. And what's the point? They're the ones who actually are having this voracious meal in spirit. Joseph is over there in this pit, nothing to drink, nothing to eat. They're over here feeding their faces, and they're being pictured here as those very animals, those wild beasts that they are going to accuse of having taken their brother. And this was his experience. And God is not stepping in to work a miracle. God is not doing for him the kinds of things that he did for Abraham, the kinds of things immediately that he did for Jacob. And actually, it's going to be a long time before the Lord does anything that's going to make this right. He is 17 here. He's going to go down to Egypt, and he's going to be promoted to a position of greatness, but he's going to be 30 years old at that point. And then you're going to go into the 7 good years, and then it's going to be a couple years into the 7 lean years before this is finally resolved. That is 22 years of unresolved family abuse. And a lot of that in other circumstances that were trials as well, whether false accusations or being left abandoned in prison unfairly, and on the story of Joseph goes. Where is God? God is not doing anything, particularly not in this chapter. And you just get this very sad picture of that caravan of traders making their way down to Egypt. And Egypt does not have very good associations so far in Genesis. And we know the story, but Joseph did not. Okay. He did not know the outcome. And God is putting all these things in here for a reason. Well, there are always two ways to look at things. And we have talked so far about the human perspective and what appears to be the silence of God. But what I want to say is that actually, no, God isn't silent. Is He silent, or is He really? Or maybe there's some other things going on as well. Maybe there's some other factors that indicate quietly, in other words, God's not shouting here. God's not stepping in to do miracles. But there are nevertheless these touches of providence that very gradually are demonstrating the activity of God and that are encouraging us to believe this is all, every last part of it, going to be taken care of in the end. You just wait. It's going to take a long time, but it is going to happen. What do we see here about the gracious providence of God? Well, I said that God doesn't speak. And He doesn't speak in words. But nevertheless, we do have a very clear revelation of God that is going on beginning at verse 5. And I'm talking here about the dreams that Joseph receives. And really what moves him to share them with his family was his conviction that this represented God's message, God's plan for the future. I don't understand it all. I don't know how this is going to happen, but this dream didn't come out of nowhere. These people believed that God spoke to them in dreams. Now, it's interesting as you compare what's happening here with the other manifestations of God and His Word throughout Genesis. Because at the very beginning, God is very active and God Himself is speaking. Remember, He came down in the garden at the cool of the day. He was very active in talking to Noah and using him to save the human race and all of that. As you come to the life of Abraham, it's not quite as direct. Abraham hears from the Lord largely in dreams and visions. And then there is also, in some cases, the presence of angels. So it's as though God is taking a step back and there are these intermediaries now. At this point, there seems to be, in the dream, no verbal revelation. And it's a totally visual or symbolic thing. So the directness of the revelation is decreasing. And it is giving you the impression God is involved, but it's as though he is backing off a bit, and people are having to piece things together more. But what these people in this family know about dreams should have told them, we really got to pay attention to this. Which is why, even though Jacob questioned, he still kept reflecting on the dreams that had been shared. Jacob himself had received dreams. And chiefly the one when he was leaving the promised land. And he sees the ladder. Remember all that in chapter 28? So he knows full well that God speaks to people in this way. And even though right now it seemed to him outrageous, he had at least a hunch that something was going on. Now, I think beyond that, as you think some more about God revealing himself, the fact that there were two, this is fascinating. Is there going to be another circumstance here coming up where there are two parallel dreams? And if you're wondering why two, it's very helpful that this book tells you the answer as to why there were two. And jump ahead with me for a moment to chapter 41 of Genesis when Joseph is talking to Pharaoh. Genesis chapter 41 and verse 32. He tells this man, the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God and God will shortly bring it about. In other words, the doubling of it is a form of emphasis to get across the idea, look, I am going to do this. It is fixed. It's going to happen. There's no question. Just like in any kind of communication, you really want to make a point, you say it again. And repetition is so important to teaching. Well, God is doing the same thing in the dream. He gives the dreams twice. And this brings up an aspect in the story of Joseph that people who study literature have often marveled at. And that is how there are so many doubled accounts. Same kind of things happen twice throughout the story. And let me just read you one man's summary of this. This is coming from Bruce Waltke. Joseph has two escalating dreams. He has escalating double trouble with his brothers. Tamar's successful seduction of Judah in the next chapter is followed immediately with Potiphar's wife's unsuccessful seduction of Joseph. So you got Judah and Tamar over here, you got Joseph and Potiphar's wife over here. Joseph interprets two sets of dreams. He's got two buddies in prison who have dreams, and then he has the dreams of Pharaoh that I just mentioned. The brothers devise two plans to deal with him, and he devises two plans to deal with them in chapter 42. The brothers make two trips to Egypt. Joseph's steward first tests the brothers, and then Joseph himself tests Judah. The narrator twice tells the family's migration there, both in beginning of chapter 46 and then chapter 46 at the end and into chapter 47. Jacob first blesses Joseph and his sons and then all his own sons, so there's a double blessing going on. The book closes pairing the deaths of two patriarchs, Jacob on the one hand and Joseph on the other. Now listen to this. Why am I going through all this? This striking symmetry and pairing in the account style matches its theology. It subtly points to the unseen hand of providence. And it's just beautiful when you put all this together and you see how there are these patterns that keep repeating themselves. Looking back on it all and putting it all together, you realize, man, this is just totally orchestrated by God. I mean, how in the world could there accidentally be two of all these things over and over and over again? The point is, God's at work. He is incredibly at work. It's just that at the time, you can't quite make out all the pieces of the puzzle, but wow, what a beautiful piece of art when you put it all together. And he actually is speaking. He's speaking in other ways as well. I mentioned there verses 15 to 17. This seems kind of a happenstance. A man found him wandering in the field. So here's this Joseph walking around looking for his brothers, and this random guy just happens to be there, runs into him, and he says, "What are you doing? Looking for my brothers." "Oh, well, I just happened to have heard that I overheard them say, we're going to Dothan." You know, how did this guy end up being at the right place at the right time two times? First of all, to hear the brothers make that comment, and second of all, to be wherever Joseph was to tell him. It's amazing how God put this man, whoever he was, at the right place at the right moment. And then you see God's hand in other ways as well. With what all this was doing in the life of Jacob, the father, at the very end. Did you pick up this parallel? How did they deceive their father? It had to do with a goat, and it had to do with a piece of clothing. And was there not a time earlier in this book when Jacob was deceiving his brother by cooking goat and by dressing up with his brother's clothing? And keep that in mind, because that's going to come up again a little bit later in this book. And now, of course, unbeknownst to him at the time, he is the victim of very parallel deception. It's as though the Lord is saying, what goes around comes around, and you are reaping in the lives of your children the consequences of your own choices, and it really hurts. This is what you did, basically, to your father. Is God at work, or is God silent? The way that these events unfold, using the wicked and on-the-spot decisions of the brothers as to how they're going to work this out, to send a message that in time Jacob is going to get about his bad choices as a father. God's at work, again, chastening this man. And at the very end, it is a bit troubling. You don't know what's going to happen when you read that he's sold off into Egypt. But it does raise some hope for you. Knowing all this talk about royalty and the dress that he was given to communicate this special position, and then the dreams, you know, how's he going to end up in that position of authority? Well, it just so happens that when he is sold, the person who happens to buy him is an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, that puts him right in the middle of the court of the highest power of the land. And that's all going somewhere. Again, it's not going to all unfold right away. And for us, it's just a matter of chapters. For him, it was 22 years. And yet, there is enough here by way of encouragement, both for him and particularly for us, to believe that God actually is very much at work. Now, we could actually take it a step further to see God's providence in all of this. And through the history of the church, a lot of people have seen so many parallels between Joseph and Christ that they actually describe him as a type of Christ. I don't know that I would go that far, but I would say in the providence of God, at the least, there are some pretty impressive parallels. And maybe at a later time, we will look at some of those. But at this point, the one that stands out to me is the fact that at a certain point in the story, Joseph is not talking anymore. He was talking at the beginning, but as soon as he enters this period of suffering and this thing explodes, you don't get anything about his feelings, you don't get anything about his struggles, you don't get anything about his reaction to all of that. And he really is establishing a pattern of the righteous way to suffer. A pattern that is going to come to a climax in the Lord Jesus Christ, the servant of the Lord, who opened not his mouth when he was tormented and unjustly punished, just like this man was. And looking back, we have, with that kind of connection, even greater evidence of the involvement of God to encourage us to believe. Now, I remember years ago studying the life of Joseph and being struck with a verse in the book of Psalms as a huge clue as to what to make of all of this. And we're wrapping up here, but turn with me to Psalm 105, which is a historical psalm that recounts a lot of the big events in the history of God's people. And just the way it phrases it here really gives us a perspective on what was going on in Joseph's life through those 22 years of waiting. And we'll drop into the statements about him in verse 16, Psalm 105, 16. When he summoned the famine, that is God, when God summoned the famine on the land and broke all supply of bread, he had sent a man ahead of them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron. Until what he had said where? Through the dreams, came to pass. This is what was going on. The word of the Lord tested him. And then after that period, he's released and he's put in position of authority and so forth. That's what was happening. The word of the Lord, God's revelation through those dreams that he had banked his hopes on because he knew it came from God, that word, through the silent years, the years of delay, the years of waiting, that word was testing him. Are we prepared for the possibility that there could be huge swaths of our lives that when the end of the story is told, God will look back and say, not a whole lot was going on in your life for those years, but what was happening was, my word was testing you. That is, I was testing to see whether you would persevere believing in the face of all manner of discouraging circumstances. I don't think these things are here just because this is what God did with Joseph. We understand that these things are here as a pattern, and that in fact the Lord often takes these people through these sorts of experiences of delay and waiting in order to grow, in order to test their faith. Which is precisely what we've been talking about all along in this book. Because it's all about the promises. It's all about hanging on to the hope of that which appears to be impossible. Whether it is this long-range thing about blessing all families of the earth, or just the immediate thing, I need a son. At all levels and through all kinds of circumstances, this is what is taking place. And it's almost like these people are growing up to the point where God is having to get involved less and less in their lives directly. And he just sort of shoves them out the door a little bit more, to walk by faith and not by sight, to where, at a certain point, we spoke of the spiritual gifts and the sign gifts and all, I think this ties in. He's no longer doing these miraculous things all the time like he did at certain points in history. And this is a way of testing our faith, actually. And what specifically was the concept that Joseph was trusting in about God? Certainly the promise, certainly about his ruling over his family and all of that. But he learned even more than that, because he himself gives us the theme of all of these chapters about these events, both in his life and life of his brothers. Probably the most famous statement in Genesis 37 to 50 is what he said to his brothers at the very end, that whereas you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. Or, where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. Or, God is able to use even the wicked to accomplish his good purposes. Or, God will keep his promises and will even use people's violence and hatred as a way of advancing his promises. What we have seen all along, we're going to see very vividly, and in some cases very painfully, demonstrated in the life of this man, who stands for us as yet another remarkable testimony of the faithfulness of God. I remember the title of a book by Francis Schaeffer. He is there, and he is not silent. That's what we've seen tonight.